let's continue to read, and one of the things we're doing this way is slowly putting together the various pieces, the various bricks of the building, as we'll need to kind of have an overview of what maybe the Buddha was doing when he was talking about not-self. So we have this Nakulapita Sutta that we could read. And if someone would be so kind as to begin reading for a while, and then when you feel like you've read enough, stop and let someone else take over.
I have heard that on one occasion, the Blessed One was living among the Bhagas at Crocodile Haunt in the Gasakula Grove at the Deer Park. Then the householder, Nakulapita, went to the Blessed One and on arrival, having bowed down to him, sat to one side. As he was sitting there, he said to the Blessed One, Lord, I'm a feeble old man, aged, advanced in years, having come to the last stage of life. I am afflicted in body and ailing with every moment, and it is only rarely that I get to see the Blessed One and the monks who nourish the heart. May the Blessed One teach me, may the Blessed One instruct me for my long-term benefit and happiness. So it is, householder, so it is. The body is afflicted, weak, and encumbered. For who, looking after this body, would claim even a moment of true health except through sheer foolishness? So you should train yourself. Even though I may be afflicted in body, my mind will be unafflicted. That is how you should train yourself. Then the householder, Nakulapita, delighting in and approving of the Blessed One's words, rose from his seat and bowing down to the Blessed One and circumambulating him, keeping him to his right, went to Venerable Sariputta and on arrival, having bowed down to him, sat to one side. As he was sitting there, Venerable Sariputta said to him, your faculties are clear and calm, householder, your complexion pure. Have you had the opportunity today of listening to a Dhamma talk in the presence of the Blessed One? How could it be otherwise, Venerable Sir? Have just now been sprinkled by the Blessed One with the deathless ambrosia of the Dhamma talk. And how were you sprinkled by the Blessed One with the deathless ambrosia of the Dhamma talk? Just now I went to the Blessed One and on arrival, having bowed down to him, sat to one side. As I was sitting there, I said to him, Lord, I'm a feeble old man, aged, advanced in years, having come to the last stage of life. I'm afflicted in body and ailing with every moment. And it's only rarely that I get to see the Blessed One and the monks who nourish the heart. May the Blessed One teach me. May the Blessed One instruct me for my long-term benefit and happiness. When this was said, the Blessed One said to me, so it is, householder, so it is. The body's afflicted, weak and encumbered. For who, looking after this body, would claim even a moment of true health except through sheer foolishness? So you should train yourself. Even though I may be afflicted in body, my mind will be unafflicted. That is how you should train yourself. That's how I was sprinkled by the Blessed One with the deathless ambrosia of the Dhamma talk.
But why didn't it occur to you to question the Blessed One further in what way is one afflicted in body and afflicted in mind? And in what way is one afflicted in body but unafflicted in mind? I would come from a long way away to hear the explication of these words in Venerable Sariputta's presence. It would be good if Venerable Sariputta himself would enlighten me as to their meaning. Then in that case, householder, listen and pay close attention. I will speak. As you say, Venerable Sir, the householder, Nakulapita responded. Venerable Sariputta said, now how is one afflicted in body and afflicted in mind? There is the case where an uninstructed, run-of-the-mill person who has no regard for noble ones is not well-versed or disciplined in their Dhamma, who has no regard for men of integrity, is not well-versed or disciplined in their Dhamma, assumes form, the body, to be the self, or the self as possessing form, or form as in the self, or the self as in form. He is obsessed with the idea that I am form, or or form is mind. As he is obsessed with these ideas, his form changes and alters, and he falls into sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair over its change and alteration. He assumes feeling to be the self, or the self as possessing feeling, or feeling as in the self, or the self as in feeling. He is obsessed with the idea that I am feeling, or feeling is mine. As he is obsessed with these ideas, his feeling changes and alters, and he falls into sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair over its change and alteration.
And then so forth for the next three skandhas. It's the same formula. And then if you want to skip down to the bottom.
This householder one is afflicted in body and afflicted in mind. And how is one afflicted in body but unafflicted in mind? There is a case where a well-instructed noble disciple who has regard for noble ones is well-versed and disciplined in their dharma. Who has regard for men of integrity is well-versed and disciplined in their dharma. Does one assume form to be the self, or the self as possessing form, or form as in the self, or the self as in form? He is not obsessed with the idea that I am form, or form is mine. As he is not obsessed with these ideas, his form changes and alters, but he does not fall into sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, or despair over pain and aggravation. He does not assume feeling to be the self. He does not assume perception to be the self. He does not assume fabrications to be the self. He does not assume consciousness to be the self, or the self as possessing consciousness, or consciousness as in the self, or the self as in consciousness. He is not obsessed with the idea that I am consciousness, or consciousness is mine. As he is not obsessed with these ideas, his consciousness changes and alters, but he does not fall into sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, or despair over its change and alteration. This householder is how one is afflicted in body, but unafflicted in mind. That is what Venerable Sariputta said, gratify the householder. Nakula Pika, delighted with Venerable Sariputta's words.
So a few things I might point out about this. One is the idea of being obsessed. And now none of us, of course, think that we are obsessed by any of these things. But I think obsession is a very broad word. And even if we don't consciously identify ourselves with the body or the feelings or the perceptions or the mental formations or the consciousness, We often will do that unconsciously and unthinkingly. And with mindfulness, one of the functions of mindfulness is to begin drawing out the places where we get stuck, the places where we get obsessed or get contracted, the areas of our life that we take to be the self or somehow refer to the self, and thereby we contract or get tight around it. And the mind then becomes afflicted. The mind becomes oppressed by these kinds of concerns. And now someone, for example, who's very much concerned about the wrinkles on their face might not think that what they're doing is identifying their body with the self, but it doesn't take much analysis to realize that that's basically what they're doing. They identify their wrinkles on their face as saying, having something to do with their self-image and how other people see them, how they see themselves, and how they want to be seen. And then they get afflicted by this obsession about their wrinkles. So I think that it doesn't take a lot of analysis to begin exploring in a person's individual personal life the way in which this formulaic kind of description here applies. I mean, this is very formulaic, so some people get turned off and say, well, this has nothing to do with my experience. But the formula is that... is supposed to be filled in by you in your practice. So what I see and I read the Buddha's teachings of anatta, is they're meant to be very much practice instructions. They're not meant to be something to be believed in. They're not meant to be something to kind of adopt blindly, but rather to be encouragements to do the investigation yourself, to develop your exploration, your investigation, to see where is it that you identify? What is it you identify with? How does identification work in your life? What is it you where do you take some experience of life, some event of life, and then associate it with some notion or image of self, some representation of self, that it makes some statement about oneself? One of the more dramatic places to see where self plays itself out, where we get obsessed about it, is in comparative thinking. And in particular, comparative thinking, what other people think about us, or how we think other people might think about us. And when we're concerned about what other people will think, then, if it's your turn to read, or you haven't read yet, and you're concerned about, I can't read, because then I'll just embarrass myself, or as you're reading, you say, I can't do that, I skipped a word, and what are people going to think of me now? And, self comes into play, and we then identified self with something, with an activity, or with a disposition, or a tendency, or the interpretation of that. And as soon as we obsess or get identified with these kinds of things, then the mind becomes afflicted. And what's I think a marvelous statement here is that you can't expect to have the body unafflicted. I mean, the body gets old and whatever, but the mind can be unafflicted. And I remember Upandita, my teacher in Burma, he was fond of saying, the body just gets older and more decayed and worn down as you get older. And he would kind of lighten up and he'd say, but the mind. The mind just gets brighter. And to somehow the mind, is to see the mind in a sense as being separate from these five skandhas. Now, as it goes through the list of things, it includes consciousness. He assumes consciousness to be the self, and he's obsessed. And by he's obsessed, he falls into sorrow, lamentation, and so forth. And this is how one is afflicted in body and afflicted in mind. To be unafflicted in mind means he does not assume that any of the five skandhas are self, including consciousness. And so sometimes the consciousness is kind of the last bastion sometimes of identification. This is who I am. And this is a little bit of a paradox here, or a little bit odd, because the Buddha doesn't associate the mind directly with the five skandhas. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean that the mind is somehow independent of the five skandhas? If it's independent, well, that's really the self, even though they don't want to call it that. I think that my understanding is the mind is taking very, very kind of innocent words, like a reflective pronoun. It's kind of like our mental faculties, kind of as a whole, as a unit, the mind is that part of the mind that's being referred to is a part of the mind which grasps, which clings. And it's that part of the mind which can be liberated by not clinging and not grasping. And so, does that belong to the five skandhas or not? Well, probably clinging belongs to the fourth skandha, that of mental dispositions or faculties or functions of the mind. Functions of the mind. But there's not a one-to-one correspondence, because what they're focusing on here is not physiology, but rather an understanding of this very simple kind of matter-of-fact principle that you can be identified with things and thereby suffer, but you can not identify by things and therefore your mind can be at ease, your heart can be at ease. Hopefully that made some sense. So then the next reading, let me give you a chance. You want to respond to this reading? Ask questions or say something about it?
I do.
Please.
Okay, so what if you get Alzheimer's, and so you lose, a certain kind of awareness that
yes.
you've always had, but you can still be aware of the present moment, even though it doesn't make the kind of sense to you that maybe it used to.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm qualified to answer that concern of yours, but I'll say this about it. many of us will take on various dispositions that we run our life by, that we kind of operate on. Certain personality traits we take on. It's not just simply we're born with them, but we take on certain ways of talking, presenting ourselves to the world, and seeing the world, and certain attitudes. Your mother told you you're supposed to important to be kind, and so you're not necessarily a kind person, but you've learned to kind of always come forward kindly and whatever. Or some people are always cynical, and so the cynicism is always on the forefront, and that's kind of an acquired attitude that's been developed. It seems that some people, as they get older, that they don't have the energy any longer to maintain those dispositions, because the attitudes take energy to maintain. And so your energy is not there to maintain them anymore, and so some of the coarser things begin falling away, and some of the things that they were hiding then show themselves. Now, people who have put on a very social and good face, done very successfully for years, but has really been covering up their fear or their anger or whatever, suddenly the effort to be socially nice falls away, and what's underneath begins showing itself much more. And so some people actually become meaner and more spiteful as they get senile or old, or maybe get Alzheimer's or something. But the opposite can also be true, that some people who've put on a personality being really tough and mean, and no one's going to kind of tell me what to do, and as they get older, as some of this process goes on, that stops. It turns out they're really sweet and soft inside. And lo and behold, when they stop doing the energy of the coarse, mean side, it turns out that they're really nice and compassionate. So the deeper dispositions, underlying dispositions, sometimes show themselves. And if a person hasn't done the spiritual work of getting down to those deeper dispositions or sorting out those things, then you might be surprised what comes later on. The theory in Buddhist practice is that you're supposed to get down to the roots of what makes you tick. And the run-of-the-mill person has no idea what the roots are. They're just kind of in the surface of their dispositions and tendencies, attitudes. And as you sit very still and very quiet, then it's possible to start seeing the underlying motivations and then to refine them and work on them. And also see some of the coarse kind of overlaying motivations, begin working with those and changing those and reassessing where you really want to place your life. In a sense, Buddhism can be seen as premature aging, premature senility. but doing it in a healthy way. Sylvia Borstein told the story of going to visit a friend of hers who had been the president of the American Associations of Psychology or something, some very. And he developed it. And so he wasn't that far gone yet. So they went over to his house for dinner one day, and they knocked on the door, and he opened the door, and he looked at them, and he said, "I don't have a clue who you are, but you're more than welcome in my house." So that's what was underneath there for him. So you better be prepared. Does that answer your question? Vaguely? Approximately? Want to ask again?
The part about consciousness, how we think that consciousness is the self, but it really isn't. That one is kind of... It's so interesting that part was included.
Yeah. Well, I think it's one of the places people will cling.
Oh, yeah.
It's consciousness itself. I am my consciousness. I am what it, and consciousness itself is maybe not such an obvious thing to realize what it is, because according to traditional Buddhist analysis, it goes something like this, that from a distance, consciousness can seem much more unitary and much more permanent than it does when you're looking at it very carefully and up close. So the analogy would be that of if you take a flare that's lit on one end, or a candle, and you swirl it around really fast, it looks like it's a continuous circle. And you know, that's a circle over there. But you actually know that there's no way that could be a circle. It's just that the flare is in different places, and the eye just organizes it as a circle as you see it. And same thing with movies. You know, we know because we've been told that there's no one moving on the screen. It's just a lot of people kind of standing still, but they're standing still in different positions, on different moments, as the film flashes on the screen. So our poor minds can't process this very well, so we just blur it all together, so it looks like movement. But actually, no one's ever moving up there on the screen. So the same thing with consciousness. Consciousness from a distance can seem like it's unitary and permanent and moving and flowing with everything, but actually it arises and passes moment by moment. Also, in deep meditation, consciousness can disappear, but you haven't died. So if consciousness disappears, but you're still there, you know, does it really qualify? Is it so useful to identify it as yourself?
What's still there?
Yeah. How would you know? How would you know? And do you need to know? I mean, a scientist needs to know.
Would you say that?
Sure, I mean, they don't need to know, but they'd like to know.
When you say that consciousness disappears, you know, are you describing the experience of, you know, like there you are sitting looking at the mountain, and then you seem separate from the mountain, and then at some point something happens, and you clearly are not separate from the mountain. You are the mountain is just sort of all...
Uh-huh.
Unified.
Yeah.
Is that what you're talking about?
No, it's not what I had in mind. I would actually ask you not to worry about it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess I don't understand what you mean by consciousness. Then. I mean, if it goes away, but yet there's still some knowing there, some knowing that the consciousness is no.
No, there's no knowing.
There is no knowing. Yeah. Well, how do you know that it's even happened then?
Because you don't.
You have to wait till 5 o'clock.
I guess. Boy. Boy. I told you I don't know anything. I'm trying to make a good selection here, so you can, you know, let the Buddha speak for himself. So let's go on then. So who wants to read Radha?
Long day.
whatsoever feeling, whatsoever perception, whatsoever activities.
Activities here means the sankharas, the mental formations or the habit tendencies. It's that they're going through the five skandhas again. So different translators have different translations of these terms. But if you can count five and they seem approximately the same, they, you know, they're... Okay. Material object here means is form. What we earlier have been translated as form.
Whatsoever consciousness one regards thus, this is not mine, this am not I, this is not the self of me. That is seeing things as they really are by right insight. Thus Radha, in him who knows, thus in him who sees, in this body, together with its consciousness, and likewise in all external objects, are there no more ideas of I and mine, no more leanings to conceit. And Venerable Radha was yet another of the Arahants.
So that was easy for him. And he got another very, very direct teaching, and he was awakened. And so why do you think he was awakened by this teaching?
He let go.
Someone else.
Good karma.
Good karma. Karma was, it was a time for the karma to ripen?
Sure. Missing piece of the puzzle.
So one of the things, one of the reasons I wanted this selection was because maybe it's a poor translation or what, but it's a kind of a warning, because it can be read almost as if you're supposed to take on the teaching, the idea that there is no self, this is not mine, this is not I, and then to carry that teaching around with you as a filter, as a lens of how to understand your experience. Mm-hmm. Now you've been taught that there is no self in the skandhas, so now I'm going to walk around and assume that as a position. Yeah, there's no self here. Thank you. But I don't think that's what's meant. I think what's meant is an encouragement to see things directly for what they are, by right insight. Right insight means to actually see clearly and to see what's actually happening here. And as we look very carefully and very mindfully at our experience, you'll be certainly be aware of the five skandhas, what these categories are, but you also become aware of the clinging to it. You become aware of the ways in which we identify with it. And the right seeing is to see the difference between the body and the attachments we have to the body, the feelings, attachments we have to the feelings, and to see the difference, see how our attachments actually work, see actually the arising of clinging, arising of identification. And from that seeing that that the attachment, the assumptions, the fabrications of self are separate from the experience of the five skandhas. And in that clear seeing, then seeing, oh, the five skandhas themselves are not self. I'm assuming as one, I'm applying one. So it actually becomes something you see directly for yourself. It's not an attitude that you assume. And even practitioners who've had very clear experiences of anatta on retreat, for example, will sometimes then carry with them the memory of that experience. And the memory within, they're ready to interpret everything. It's like, oh, that's not self. Even though there might be self operating, that memory as a concept, as a teaching is what they're operating on. And I don't think that's very healthy. I don't think that we're supposed to kind of go around with that as an operating principle we're supposed to adopt for ourselves. But rather we want to come back always to the practice itself and develop more clearly to see for ourselves what's actually going on. Because if you adopt the operating principle of there's no self here, what we do then is we tend to blind ourselves to what's actually going on much, much more deeply. So right insight is what's called upon here. And then this idea that there's no more I and no more mine. Mine is a little bit more the, what we say, modern world identification. We identify with something as mine. And I is conceit. No, he says, no more leanings on conceit. So it's not just simply that there is no belief absence of a belief in something as being the self, but there's no conceit around the whole notion of I am. And it isn't conceit in the sense that I am superior. It's any notion of I am at all. The person no longer is disposed to think of themselves in that kind of reflective mode, I am, I exist. Now, that for us modern people seems absurd. I mean, all of us exist, and what's wrong with kind of thinking that I am? You know, since you are, right? But that kind of reflective conceit, I think, is absent. One of the ways of maybe understanding this, I don't know if this is a good example, but it's clear, these days it's clearest for me when I, sometimes when I, and for me it's kind of like a very powerful meditation practice for me to be participating in these interviews. And in the sense I have is in a way, there is no reflective, no concern about me, who I am and that I am even. In a sense, I disappear during these interviews, kind of engaged in what I'm talking about with people. But it isn't that I'm absorbed in the other person, completely focused and concentrated on just the external person that I'm talking to and what they're saying. I'm equally attentive to what goes on inside of me. I'm aware of the feelings, the reactions, the thoughts, the intuitions that are happening within me. But I haven't posited a self, an I, that I'm referencing those feelings and those thoughts and those reactions. It's as if the boundary or the wall or the container of self as an idea, as a concept, has disappeared. So it's kind of transparent or translucent. But I'm equally tracking inside and outside. So if you think that means you're not supposed to no longer track what goes on in here, then it's actually quite dangerous, because then you're kind of just with the other person, and you have no idea what your own feelings and thoughts are, and you might act, you know, make inappropriate statements or actions. But if you're completely not tuning into the other person, completely absorbed in your own, how it is for you, and your own thoughts and your own feelings and the meanings and implications of all that some people can be, then they get lost in that world and they're not connected to the world outside. And I think that what's possible in this, with the dropping of some kind of conceit to the I am, is that it doesn't mean that we disappear as a being, as a person. It means that there's something extra which is dropped. That wall, or that boundary, or that attachment, or that holding, that clinging, that gets caught up in self-reflective analysis, self-reflective assigning a meaning, what this means, or what this says, what this says in terms of the representation of myself. What does this say about me? What are the implications of myself and my self-concern? So that drops away, and there's still this very careful mindfulness that can happen, very clear awareness that can happen of what goes on inside, the thoughts and all that. And because of that, we can be responsible of what we're doing. It can be kind of a self-responsibility for tracking all these things, and we know what's appropriate and not appropriate. So the idea of selflessness is not meant to mean that we become completely unaware of what, in a normal, conventional way, we call the self. It just means that the movement of conceit around that which disappears and comes away. Well, I think there's any kind of reflective notion that I am. And once you say I am, then there's some latching on to meaning to that I am, or implications of that, associations to that I amness, attachment to it. So if I am, if I'm talking to you now, I can just be talking to you and trying to come up with the best response I can, trying to see what makes sense, and getting a sense of how you're reacting, and what's useful to you and what's not useful, and all these things. That seems normal. But then I can be aware of I am the person who's speaking. I know that I'm speaking, and I'm aware of speaking happening in my thoughts and everything. But then I say, I'm the one who's speaking, and suddenly I am is here. And now that I am is here, I wonder what other people think about my answer. My God, you know. This is rather, embarrassing. So, but that I am, be concerned about I am, doesn't have to exist there. While I'm paying attention to the fact that I'm thinking and speaking and listening to you. Part of practice is not to trick ourselves or necessarily into being a not self-person. Drop it automatically. The practice does is we really want to see how this operates in ourselves. So part of the function of practice is to help us see the bad news really well. Because by seeing it really well, how detachment works, then we can have a realistic sense of going beyond it. But if we have attachment, if we're clinging, and then we assume some posture, some attitude, I'm not going to be that way, then it's going to operate there anyway, kind of in the background or unconsciously. So part of practice is to really be very, very honest about how we actually operate. And by that honesty, then it's going to seeing what's on your side. That's me. That's me.
You see my question? I mean, you're presenting my question.
Uh-huh.
It's when you say,
there's speaking going on, and there's thinking going on. There's listening to her, what's going on. Yes. Oh, so there's a global awareness of seeing all that stuff going on. Well, awareness is always the container. But I don't know if you want to say that awareness is necessarily the self.
Awareness
being
consciousness,
you
see words the same,
consciousness?
Yeah,
we can use
them
synonymously.
So ego? Ego is synonym for what we're talking about here with self and self-awareness, or are you not putting that in?
Ego, you have to define the word ego because it's not a Buddhist word. It's
right, I'm thinking of, I'm not pronouncing his name right, but it's Tibetan monk. Chogyam Trungpa.
Yeah.
I mean, he uses ego. What is it? In a couple of his works, wasn't he one of the Buddhists that sort of used ego when he was writing in English about? And I was just curious if that is what he meant by anatta, or getting rid of self.
Getting rid of the ego.
Yeah, if that's like how a Westerner would see Freud's concept of ego. Being basically a synonym for what the Buddha was trying to tell us to strip away.
Yeah, I don't know enough about Freud anymore. I mean, some years ago, I read him and his idea of ego. I think that some of the modern definitions of ego or ego development have to do with a healthy interrelationship between. Different faculties of mind, different abilities to cognize and different abilities to understand our relationship to the world around us. And I don't think that that is in any kind of way that's not being negated by Buddhism.
Egotistic
is to be selfish. That's certainly there's something clinging there, attachment there. Jack Engler wrote a number of articles some years ago, and where he has this little cliche that he actually wrote, and then people only remember the cliche and not the whole article. And the cliche was that you have to have a self in order to let go of a self, and this was people misunderstood what he was trying to say, but that's kind of what people remember. So when people hear Buddhist teachings where, you know, supposed to be teaching not self, and well, how are you supposed to have not self? You know, you're supposed to need self first. Buddha never taught no self. Buddha never said that. There is no self. So you're not supposed to kind of go find your no self, because there is no self to find. And if you ask people, what does it mean to develop a strong sense of self? What they mean is you have to have good insight into how your mind works. You have to have a certain level of personal confidence. And you have to have a certain level of discipline. You have to have a certain level. There's all these things, these faculties that get developed. Very clear, particular faculties get developed. And in fact, you can develop all these particular faculties without the notion of self. So self is kind of like a categorical term that holds all these other things, particular things that get developed. And the particular things that are being developed are also being developed in Buddhist practice. And it's a very important part of Buddhist practice. Development of many of these faculties were supposed to be developed into powers when we do Buddhist practice. There's a lot of traditional Buddhism is called a path of cultivation. And you cultivate a lot of inner psychological forces and powers within you as part of it. And they become a support, a necessary support for the deeper work of letting go. And if a person lets go without having these strengths to kind of hold one up, it can be kind of dangerous. So the idea that you have to build a self before you let go of a self, it doesn't really work in Buddhism, that notion. But the idea that, oh yes, you need to develop these inner qualities so that it becomes easier for you to let go of places you are attached, that certainly works. Yeah. There's many of these lists, but the seven factors of enlightenment is one of them. The five faculties are the faith, concentration, mindfulness, energy and wisdom, and they become the five powers. Those are the seven factors of awakening, the four roads to power. Yeah.
When you were talking about being outside yourself in during an interview and trying to define what is conceit,
I'm not outside of myself.
Sorry.
This is very important. This is very important. Is to get the language right. Otherwise, we start positing a self again.
True. Okay. Well, anyway, what has come to mind is this may not be a matter of this may be a matter of frames of reference. Let's have a little map where we remember how some problems are insoluble until you change the frame of reference.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden, things that were insoluble will become easy, and a different set of problems.
Perfect.
Most of us go through life with a frame of reference that has ourselves at the center, and everything else at a certain distance away. Literally, front of us, behind us, and possessions, my car, not my car, my clothes, not my clothes. And measuring everything in that respect. And what was being suggested here is switching frames of reference. The facts don't change. The phenomena in the world don't change. But in your measuring the distances between things, the relations between things, on a global framework in which you are just one other element. You're making sense.
You're making a lot of sense to me. This is exactly right. I think that's exactly what the Buddha was trying to encourage people to do, was to change their frame of reference. And that some frames of reference, like the reference of a self, is not a useful frame of reference to certainly for practice points of view, spiritual work, point of view of spiritual work, but it's not a useful frame of reference in general. Or maybe certain areas might be a useful frame of reference, but for the purpose of spiritual life, it's not a useful frame of reference. And so one of the things we'll see as we do continue with the reading is the Buddha actually very specifically suggests changing that frame of reference to something else, and that we'll see what that is. And the issue with self is that for many people, in many ways in which we take a positive self, that is a self-limiting concept. And so as long as we use that frame of reference, we're stuck in a system that loops back on itself, or it doesn't get us out of that system, or limits our thinking in some way.
But Gil, actually, based on what he just said, I thought that this reading was saying, don't take one particular frame of reference and have it fixed. That he was saying you have to, be with what is happening now, right, insight. And so not to say, okay, well, the frame of reference is now no self, or the frame of reference is self, but you just have to see every experience for what it is.
Well, in a sense, yes. The way that Tanisara Bhikkhu translates the four foundations of mindfulness is, as we said earlier, so the four frames of references. So one of the frames of references you can take is to see things that way. So you switch out of looking at things through the concept of a self into the frame of reference of seeing things as they're directly experienced. So that's a frame of reference. But as we'll see later, there's another frame of reference which the Buddha recommends it's kind of stepping back and take a broader view, which is particularly useful for the purposes of practice.
So there is a frame of reference that you can
kind of. Take the expression frame of reference somewhat loosely. You know, if you want the sunlight to come through into your house, you don't open the window that's on the north side of the house, because no sun's going to come in then, right? So if you want certain results, you want to open the right window, right frame of reference, and so you want to open the south facing window.
And
live inside a
hemisphere.
Yes. Yes.
Frame of reference. Yeah.
And the next one, the Akappa, is probably pretty much the same. The mind has gone away from all thought of I and mine, is gone from conceit, is passed beyond the ways of conceit, is calmed and utterly released. And this, I don't think this implies that the person then has become completely unaware of what their thoughts and their feelings and their reactions. But there's no I-am-ness added to that. So what I want to do now is to go through, in the next page, a little bit of a kind of a summary or overview of the major themes on self and not self that I've been able to identify in the suttas. So the first, a lot of this review now of what we've talked about so far. So first, on uses of the word self. There's certainly the conventional and ordinary uses of self. For example, myself, by oneself. Nowhere is the ordinary reflective use of self denied. It is common all over the suttas in the discourse of the Buddha. Then two, personal responsibility, continuity, self-development, and self-reliance. Individual responsibility and independence is repeatedly stressed in the suttas. Purity and impurity belong to oneself. No one purifies another. The noble path of practice is described as the way by which one with a great self travels. So it, whatever the teachings of anatta are, they're not meant to do away with any sense of personal responsibility. And in fact, personal responsibility is actually very strongly emphasized by the Buddha. So in a sense, even though there might be, in this kind of popular understanding of Buddhism, no self, there is, you're still very much responsible for your own practice, for your own actions, and for the consequences of your actions. If I steal someone else's apple, and then you guys decide, well, that's not good, and we should, stealing is not good, I think we should punish somebody, so let's punish Don. I mean, you know, that doesn't make sense, right? I mean, if I'm the one who stole the apple, then probably, you know, I should take the consequences for it. So the idea of continuity, of personal continuity, is taken for granted in this tradition, that there is some kind of continuity of the person through time. And one of the ways to understand it is to think of the human being as a stream rather than as an entity, as a thing, as a river. And in fact, the river analogy is often used in Buddhism for the person. That and a stream or a river has a certain integrity to it, right? It has the banks and follows the banks of the river, and one we have one river and maybe a mile away we have another river, and it's very clear which is which, and there's certain integrity to that river that doesn't change too easily through time. But if you go into the river and you want to identify something as the self of the river, and you take a bucket of water and pull it out of the river and hold up the bucket and say, look everyone, I have the self of the river here, people are just going to laugh at you. I mean, you don't have the river anymore in that bucket. You have the water that was in that river, but the river is no longer in that bucket. It's just water then, right? So that river has no essential self, even though it has some kind of integrity, a stream that's held together by the banks of the river. In the same way, the individual person has integrity to it through time. There's a certain a container for that. The traditional container for that would be considered to be karma. That the karma is there's two kinds of karma, or let's say it this way. There's one of the things that holds the stream of our integrity together, or continuity together, is the stream of cause and effect relationships. And those cause and effect relationships have integrity through time to some degree. An analogy for this is sometimes used in the ancient Buddhist tradition is that of a mango. If a person plants a mango tree, takes a mango seed and puts it in the ground and grows a mango tree, and then new mangoes grow from that tree. A farmer goes out in the field and plants a mango, and the tree grows, and new mango fruit grows from that tree. There's enough continuity between the seed that farmer planted and the new mangoes that grew in that tree that we can say that the new mangoes belong to that farmer. We don't say they belong to, you know, they don't belong to him. Even though the mango on the tree is not the same mango that was planted, there is a continuous connection between the mango that was planted and the mangoes on the tree. So in the same way with us human beings, that there's continuity through time, where we don't have to posit something being passed through time, but there is a cause and effect relationship that has some integrity to it that allows us to say, well, this belongs to me, this belongs to that person. This is one continuous stream through time. So when the Buddha talks about atta or self, I think he's quite comfortable talking about continuity through time. Very comfortable with talking about personal development, self-development. These things aren't being negated in any kind of way. If anything, these are being championed as being a very important part of the tradition. Some people, and rightfully, could almost say, maybe could criticize Buddhism for being excessively focused on the individual at times. That it's a very, it's one of the great, powerful self-help movements that ever existed. You know, tremendous emphasis on personal development and personal, you know, it's up to you to you know, the Buddha only points the way. You have to walk the path. You have to do the practice. The idea that anyway, so that's the point here in number two, on self. This is no negation of personal responsibility, no negation of continuity, of self-development and self-reliance. And in fact, in continuity in the Buddhist tradition goes beyond this particular lifetime. And so there's some integrity to the continuity through lifetimes. And is it you that gets reborn? So when you die and you get reborn as an earthworm, is that, you know, you didn't say, well, now, you know, now I'm an earthworm, you know. That's who I am now, I'm an earthworm. I mean, if you were an earthworm in your last lifetime, and then you got reborn as a human being, maybe you can just equally say, well, you know, you're an earthworm reborn as a human. You know, who are you? What are you? What do you identify as a self? Is kind of difficult when you talk about rebirth over time. There's continuity, but there's no self. They said there's no inherent quality, permanence in that. And it may be in the same way as the analogy of the mango. There's continuity of growth of the mango through time. And in a sense, the new mango on the tree is a continuity of that mango that was planted. And it's the same genes and, you know, whatever. And it's not an apple. But is it really the same thing? Is the rebirth that comes when you die, is that you? There's certainly continuity, and that continuity is shaped by this particular stream that you've created in this lifetime. The integrity of that stream continues in some way. But to what degree is it justified to say, well, that's myself being reborn? I don't know. I'm confused, right? I don't know if it makes sense to call that. We have such an amazingly strong bias of seeing things through the point of view of the self, of myself, ourselves, that it's very hard for us to imagine anything else but, you know, if there is rebirth, then I'm the one who's being reborn. But maybe that's not exactly the case. Though to say that it's someone else being reborn is not the case either. There is a continuity.
So, the example that you just gave kind of struck something in my head, which is that, so in the mango example, the physical connection is the same genetic material, this and that, but in the reincarnation example, is not physical.
Right.
So more or less, I guess, one way to look at the question is there a soul? Or something to that effect.
Right. What is the substratum? What is the ground? Or what is the container for that continuity? Is there a thing that holds that material of the karma of rebirth of the person? And the Buddhism doesn't see any need to posit a thing to hold that. In a sense, it's consciousness which is the holder, in a sense. But then consciousness is not seen to be a unitary, permanent thing. It's kind of like, and again, now this is an area where I don't feel like I have a very good grasp of what Buddhism wants to teach. I mean, I've studied for years and years this stuff, and this very central question, which is very fair and is often asked, is, you know, what is if Buddhism, in fact, posits that there's no enduring self. And it wants at the same time posit that there is rebirth. What is the mechanism for that rebirth? How does that happen? How is it that I can die here and get reborn, you know, as a worm in Afghanistan, You know, how does that happen? You know.
Do you think of the term self and soul as similar or equivalent or?
No. So I've studied this for a long time, and I haven't been very satisfied with the answer to this question. So maybe other people have better answers than I do, better understanding. But the my best way of understanding it is that it's like the waves in the ocean. If you look at a wave traveling across the Pacific from Japan to the coast of California, if you track it, it seems like the same wave is going all the way across. But if you study the physics of that water, you know that the molecule that make up that wave is not moving through. There's no molecules of water moving across the Pacific. It's a molecule of water that's going up and down, and through the energy of going up and down, it's striking the water molecule next to it, and then that strikes the water molecule next to that, and it goes down like that. And so you get the illusion of a wave, of something which is moving through the ocean, but nothing's moving through the ocean. It's kind of like what's called the wave in sports theaters. You know, there's no hand moving across the arena, but it just looks like there's movement because everyone's doing it kind of together. So consciousness is momentary, they say, and so consciousness in a sense gets vibrated a certain way, and depending on at the moment of death, it's vibrating a certain way, and then it strikes another consciousness that comes in its field, and it puts a different vibration in that, and that then vibrates and strikes another one, and so there's some continuity in the stream of that consciousness, but there's no consciousness which is moving. In the same way, there's no water molecule moving across the Pacific.
So then where does karma fit in? So how, so what about this being reborn?
So depending on the size of the pebble that the Japanese person uses to throw into the water, if it's a small little pebble or a big boulder, it affects the size of that wave that goes across the Pacific. And then the person decides to throw two rocks in, and one goes in and one goes in a little bit further to the right of that one, then you have a wave pattern, and that wave pattern strikes, and those two waves then affect, you know, form a different kind of wave that moves across the Pacific. So in the same way, if depending on the actions we do in this lifetime, we put a certain spin onto our consciousness, and that spin then affects the next one that it strikes, and that affects the kind of spin that one has, or the next one doesn't have a spin until it receives the spin from this one, and so then it moves down through time. So that's the only way that I can save, that kind of way of talking about it, is the only way I can save Buddhism from the idea that maybe there is some, in the end, some kind of permanent substratum that holds karma to go from one lifetime to the next. That's my understanding to date. Does that make sense? I mean, it doesn't have to be satisfying.
Gil, does self and rebirth in your question, does attachment relate to that? Because it would seem that maybe if without attachment there wouldn't be a self, and there wouldn't also, is it right to say that rebirth has to do with attachment, and if someone has let go of attachment, there no longer is rebirth? Is that
right, that's exactly it. So that's why when Sue said, you know, what gets reborn is our bad habits. It's rebirth only happens because there's clinging.
And so the self means clinging or attachment. Right?
Sorry?
The self means attachments or clinging, doesn't it?
The self means attachment or clinging.
Doesn't that mean that, I mean, if you didn't have clinging, there wouldn't be a self?
Well, you have to be very careful. The Buddha never said there's no self.
I didn't either.
So the question you asked shouldn't be answered in Buddhist circles. Now, if there's no clinging, there will no longer be rebirth. And so the theory is that rebirth only happens because there's clinging. So it's kind of like if well, what would be a good analogy for that?
Fuel of a plane.
Fuel for the flame. Yeah, well, that's a good analogy because the word for clinging and the word for fuel in Pali is the same word. And so so there's a way in which clinging itself is the continuing fuel for continued rebirth, for continual existence, upadana.
So,
and there's no more fuel for continued existence. There's no more clinging. So it's kind of like what happens. I guess what happens is when you die. Now, it's very hard. I don't know how to talk about this in any way that makes good sense in Buddhist terms, but it's kind of like your consciousness then floats free, and if there's clinging, if there's fear or attachment to something, then that consciousness will immediately look for something to grab onto and will coalesce again. If there's no attachment, that consciousness just dissolves. It kind of dissolves. The Buddha never said dissolved. That's Gill saying that. As you remember the earlier, the undisclosed questions. Does a Tathagata, does an enlightened person exist after death? Do they not exist after death? The Buddha didn't want to answer those questions. So the Buddha certainly didn't want to say that the Tathagata, that the enlightened person doesn't exist after death. They also don't want to say that they exist after death. So what's the alternative? Is there an alternative to that? And there's several ways of responses. One is, some years ago I thought was very satisfying, but nowadays I don't think it's necessarily the Buddhist position. And that is that if there is no self to begin with, then there's no self to talk about either dying or either continuing or not continuing. So for example, if you're watching television and you see this person, an animated character, on cartoon character on television, and you turn off the television, and then you ask, did that cartoon character die? Where's that cartoon character now? Was there before and now it's gone? Does it not exist anymore? Does it exist now? Some other form? But actually, you don't want to answer that question because it never existed to begin with. It was just an animated figure. It didn't exist there like a real entity, living thing. So it's a wrong question to ask. If you assume that animated character really exists as a being, then you can ask, well, what happens to that being when you turn off the television? But you know that it doesn't exist as a real being, so the question doesn't make any sense. It doesn't go anywhere. It never was anywhere to begin with. So the teaching, if you understand there's no self, then the question of what happens to the self when you die becomes nonsensical. Whether it continues or doesn't continue, whatever. Lately, I've been thinking that's not a very satisfying answer to this issue because the Buddha never said there was no self. And he didn't say there was a self either. Maybe it's the right answer. Maybe that's the way. But I think that I suspect that there might have been a whole other thing going on. I'll bring this. I have his books and a few copies in the car. I'll bring, and those of you who don't have it can take a copy home, called "Mind Like Fire Unbound" by Tanisara Bhikkhu, where he posits this, that fire is used as the analogy for the mind or for the self, And that liberation is the traditionally in it has to do somehow with the ending of that flame of fire. And many modern scholars have thought it meant the extinguishing of that fire. But the extinguishing of fire seems very close to annihilationism, which the Buddha was very clear that he didn't believe in. And he didn't want to say that when an enlightened person dies, they're extinguished. He didn't want to say that. So maybe there's something about the flame analogy we don't understand. So Tanisiro Bhikkhu went back and studied how ancient Indians understood what fire was. And what he found was that they think of fire, they thought of fire very differently than how we in modern world think of fire. Though perhaps they understood it a little bit more like how we think of heat. The heat is in the flame. And when the flame stops burning, what happens to the heat?
It goes away.
It goes everywhere, right? And so it becomes, while there's fire there, in a sense, the heat is bound by the fire. It's held in by the fire, it's connected to the fire. But when the fire is no longer there, the heat has been, or once the fire, once the heat leaves the fire, it's been freed. You know, it goes, where does it go? And so the idea in ancient India was that fire, all the elements like fire and water and earth and air element, that they there's kind of like this conservation of energy kind of law. They're always there, but sometimes they get condensed and you can see them. And if they're not condensed, then they get absorbed into everything else. Kind of the way we understand heat. That heat, you know, isn't it the law of conservation of energy? Energy doesn't go anywhere. I mean, it doesn't leave the universe, right? So somehow when consciousness gets released, it's not like it disappears. It doesn't like it get extinguished. It's not like it continues to exist, but it's kind of like what happens to that heat, maybe. I don't know if that's a very good analogy. And I probably don't understand the physics of thermodynamics very well either. But it seems, seemingly, the way I read these texts is the Buddha doesn't want to posit the extinction of something. But he doesn't want to say that something continues either. And to what degree does it make sense to call it existing when it's not self-conscious? You know, I don't know. So this is kind of weird, right? So I don't quite understand, but it's very nice and comforting.
There is a scientific word that they use on called delocalized. So there's no longer, you know, something is no longer in a certain physical region.
Right. So the heat's been delocalized. So what good does that do me? I don't know. When I get delocalized, I die and I'm down delocalized. You know, and the Christians go to heaven and the Buddhists get delocalized. Yes.
I remember Joseph talking about the difference between the Theravada lineage, the idea, or he felt that what he had learned was that if you become a totally enlightened being, you disappear, you extinguish, versus the Mahayana idea coming back as, you know, different people, I mean, in the lineage and being that form or essence of, like different columns, supposedly, or lamas, that they are the energy of former lama. So, who knows?
Yeah, all Buddhas, when they die, do what they do. They, you know, but bodhisattvas who are not yet Buddhas might come back repeatedly, and because they're not fully, bodhisattvas still have attachment. And that's what allow. But their attachment now is often purified attachment, in the form of a vow or an aspiration to come back and be of help. And so there's something, they still have a hook that brings them back. But a Buddha's, but once you become a Buddha and once you die as a Buddha, I mean, that's it.
You're delocalized.
You're delocalized, yeah. Yes?
I think we're almost ready to start discussing how many angels we're going to take. Maybe we can start that conversation now.
That's a question.
Yes. Yes.
Do they deal with the question of there being births that are not rebirth? I mean, is there some sort of conservation of karma units or something? Or is every new birth generated by karma from a previous life?
First law of conservation of
Buddha. Yeah. I don't know how to respond to that question except that there are a phenomenal number of beings in the cosmos. So I mean, we just see the tip of the iceberg. So there's no problem, you know, with where they're coming from, where they're going, or, you know, there being more, you know. Yes.
So it sounds like reincarnation is a failure of practice rather than a reward.
Usually, that's the understanding of Buddhism. Yeah, in traditional Buddhist worldview, where rebirth or multiple lifetimes is a central part of that philosophy or teaching, the rebirth is considered to be an unfortunate thing. I mean, it's something you want to actually be finished with entirely. And you can meet, it's not so hard to meet some traditional Theravadan teachers, for example, or monks or teacher or practitioners who will say things like, you know, I really hope this is the last time, or, you know, I've had enough of this, you know. So now we've gotten into the topic of rebirth. And certainly in the suttas, it seems the Buddha accepted this as a given that there is rebirth. But in my reading of it, and I could be reading it through my bias, I don't get the impression that the teaching of rebirth was particularly important for the Buddha. Though other people would argue that some people argue that it was centrally important, and without the teachings of rebirth, Buddhism doesn't make sense.
Could it have just been cultural baggage, in the sense that he had no choice but to deal with it because it was in the milieu, so to speak, but like you're saying, it wasn't really central to his concerns? Is that a...
Maybe. I actually don't know. You know, I feel like I don't really qualify to answer a lot of these kinds of questions. I'll tell you what my bias is. So I just put that out there, and then you can kind of deal with that. Is that my sense is that you can practice Buddhism and practice the practice of liberation without any need to be concerned about the questions of rebirth. And the motivation to kind of end all rebirths, the motivation to become delocalized, doesn't have to have any role in a person's practice. As you use the expression, it's a frame of reference. The rebirth is a frame of reference for understanding our lives, which is unneeded. It's maybe useful for some people, but it's unneeded.
Yeah, I think Christian friends will say that they can be Christians without being concerned about salvation. I mean, it sounds almost like analogous to saying you can practice Buddhism, or practice what the Buddha taught, but not be concerned about the karmic or the rebirth side of it.
Right, right. And there's definitely a debate that goes on in Buddhist circles in these days about whether you need to be concerned about those issues of rebirth and multiple lives, or whether you can ignore it entirely and not believe in it. For example, you know, So that's a debate that's going on, and the clearest expression of this debate was in a Tricycle article some years ago between Stephen Batchelor and Bob Thurman. So let's go through quickly, if we can, on the not-self side of these themes, And then we'll take a break and come back for the last readings. So on themes on not self. So you have to remember here, it says not self. It's perhaps not useful or appropriate to use the expression no self as a translation of anatta. Nowhere does the Buddha say there's no self. What he says is that particular things are not self. Form is not self, feelings are not self, consciousness is not self. So it's a teaching on what is not self. It's not a teaching on there being no self. So the first one is there's no essential substance. All dharmas are not self. There is no permanent essence or substratum in things. And two, selflessness. It's a teaching on selflessness. As a spiritual practice, we should let go of our sensual desire, clinging to self, and also the I am conceit. And for most of us, this may be where the biggest spiritual work resides, is in letting go, you know, the whole work is in letting go of these kinds of clinging. Not self refers to, it's not one of the five skandhas. What we call the self is a designation, more accurately understood as made up of five heaps or aggregates: physical experience, sensation, feeling, tone, mental formations, and consciousness. By looking directly at each of the skandhas, we realize that none of them qualify as a permanent self. It's kind of like the New York analogy, New York City. I use a Stanford campus analogy, since it's local. If you go onto campus there, and you're going to show someone where Stanford is and show them what Stanford's all about, and you walk around, show this is where the library is, this is where the student union is, this is where the auditoriums are, and this is where the classrooms are, and this is where the chancellor's office is. And after a while, they say, well, that's very nice, I see all these, but where's Stanford University? And I'm showing it to you. It's, well, is the library the Stanford University? No, it's not the library. And basically you say, what's all of this? Well, all of this means what? And then you say, well, you know, it's, is it all this meaning? You mean the property we're standing on here? You know, it's private property, right? Stanford University. So I can, you go to the edge of the property, and eventually you get to the edge of it. You walk, Stanford University is not the property that's there. It's, you know, is it the students? No, it's not the students. And you can't, you know, you try. Local, pin it down. What is Stanford University? You won't find a thing which is Stanford University. And you have to somehow take the composite of many different factors. This is what makes up Stanford University, is the composite of all this stuff makes up a university. But you won't find a thing to be a university. So the self is a kind of a composite designation for this larger thing that is made up of these factors of the five skandhas. And if you want, you can divide it up differently, but that's the way the Buddha divided it up. So the self, in that sense, is a designation and not an existing thing. And then not self doctrine is a teaching that there's not a soul or atman. There's no absolute, permanent, blissful, or independent metaphysical self or soul that can be found. And in the early part of the century, people often translated anatta as no soul. And in some ways, it had some benefits because in the modern world, to translate it as not self or no self gets very complicatedly mixed up with all these different definitions we have in the West about the self and psychological selves. And before you know it, you know, people are just confusing each other with this discourse. But when you talk about soul, no soul, it seems to kind of, it's very much clearer kind of what the definitions are. Five, not self, the meditational experience of not self. No self can be experienced at all. So again, it's not a teaching that there's no self. The teaching that you can't find the self in the details of your experience. You can't, if you go to Stanford, you can't find a Stanford University in details of the experience of Stanford. You have to step back and kind of get kind of the kind of the global view of it, in a sense, to see Stanford. Now, this is a very important part of the of not self-teaching, is that it's meant to, and some people have argued, that it's only meant to be a meditation experience. That the anatta doctrine is not meant to be some kind of doctrine or theory or teaching that you're supposed to take classes like this from and understand, but rather is meant to be something that you experience in meditation practice. And the proper domain for discussing anatta is while you're in deep meditation. And to try to have a sensible conversation about it outside of meditation is maybe a little bit difficult. Now, what happens in deep Vipassana meditation is that it's kind of like going to Stanford University, and with increasingly detail, you're looking for the Stanford University there, and you can't find it. As you sit in meditation, you drop below the global concepts, the designations you have of what's happening, and you start seeing the actual details of the direct experience that's the building blocks for the concepts. And as you stay staying in for the direct details of things, you begin seeing that very clearly that this stuff doesn't, none of these things qualifies as a self. And then, in fact, after a while you realize, you look everywhere around, you realize, I can't find anything here that's a self. And then people will say, I'm having a no-self experience. And what they're I think literally saying is that I'm having an experience where I can't find any self in my experience. And there's no self to latch onto. Now, this for some people becomes very frightening, because a lot of people use the designation of self, the concepts, associated ideas to self, as an orientation for understanding their place in the world and how they measure themselves, whether they're safe in the world or secure in the world or the status in the world, or is, you know, in relationship to how other people think of them as a self, how they see themselves as a self, how self is reinforced and supported and nourished through time. And so you feel very safe that way. If you go in a situation where yourself is supported, you feel good. And if yourself is being threatened, well, then you can rouse yourself up to defend yourself, and then you can, at least you're engaged. But you can't defend yourself in deep meditation because there's no material to defend yourself with. So you're left with this kind of there without any kind of. If you're used to having a self and holding on to it and depending on it, and you're sitting there in meditation, like, you know, well, you can't find one, you know, like, what are you supposed to do then? I mean, normally we have one close at hand, and it's really easy for us, yeah. You know. And but in meditation, they're not close at hand, so it's disorienting for people at times, and it's not so uncommon for some people to have a lot of fear around this. And then, and some people will get comfortable in that state, and some people will make some great conclusion, oh, this means that I've had a no-self experience, and there's no self fundamentally or absolutely. But my understanding, and this again will be my bias or my personal take, is that the experience of anatta in deep meditation is not an experience meant to show you the metaphysical truths about the nature of self and the nature of the universe. That you're not supposed to have these deep meditation experiences of and being unable to find a self, and then leave meditation and walk around carrying this idea, now I understand what it's all about. The real function of these deep meditative experiences of not finding a self is that you realize you can begin letting go. And after a while, you learn it doesn't make any sense to grasp because there's nothing to grasp onto. And so you begin letting go, and you begin trusting letting go. And you begin trusting it's okay not to hold on to anything. And it's, in a sense, it's that trust which is important. And when you come out of deep meditation, you know, it isn't that you're supposed to carry with you the belief in self or no self or whatever. What you're hopefully carrying with you is that trust. So that when you come back in normal life, that you can continue not grasping onto things, not holding onto things. So the deep meditative experience of not-self is helping us to let go. And if anatta is the gateway to liberation, then it can take you right up to the edge of total liberation and help you with all the very final remnants of letting go that needs to happen to drop into the unconditioned. So the meditation experience of not-self is a very important part in Buddhism. And to repeat and underscore what I've said already, it might be that the teaching of not-self, its proper domain is really in this kind of deep meditative experience. Or maybe say it differently, is meant for people who can really do that kind of detailed analysis, that can really see where the notions of self arise and its details. And so in the discourses we read, the Buddha wasn't into the five ascetics, for example. These people were probably pretty advanced spiritual practitioners. So their mind was ripe for, you know, to see it this way. And so they can let go. And then the sixth step here is the no-self doctrines. No self-doctrines is the expression here. Not no-self. No self-doctrines. And what clinging to any doctrine or view about self is said to lead to suffering. So you're not supposed to have any theory or doctrine about self or no self. Isn't that great? So you take this whole class to learn about not self, and then you're told you're not supposed to cling to even that. So with that, I realize I went through it quickly. Let's take a break. For how long would you like to take a break this time?
15 minutes.
Okay, so let's start again at 3:25.
So would it be correct to point to your recorder still?
Oh.